Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya. Srimad Bhagavatam, second canto, chapter 6, Purusha Sukta confirmed, text 38. Yasya vatara karmani Gayanti Yasmad Adaya Nayam Viranti Tatvena Tasmai Bhagavate Namaha Yasya, whose avatara incarnation Karmani activities Gayanti chanting glorification. He, indeed. Asmat Adaya. Persons like us. Na. Do not. Yam. Vidanti. No. Tat Dvena. 100% as he is. Tasmai. Unto him. Bhagavate. Unto the personality of Godhead Sri Krishna. Nama, respectful obeisances. Translation. Let us offer our respectful obeisances unto that supreme personality of Godhead, whose incarnations and activities are chanted by us for glorification, though he can hardly be fully known as he is. Purport. It is said that the transcendental name, form, quality, pastimes, paraphernalia, personality, and so forth cannot possibly be perceived by the gross materialistic senses. But when the senses are purified by the process of hearing, chanting, remembering, and worship the lotus feet of the holy deity, and so forth, the Lord reveals himself proportionately to the advancement of the quality of devotional service. Ye yatama prapadyante. One should not expect the Lord to be an order-supplying agent who must be present before us as soon as we desire to see him. We must be ready to undergo the prescribed devotional duties, following the path shown by the predecessors into the simple succession from Brahma, Narada, and similar authorities. As the senses are progressively purified by bona fide devotional service, the Lord reveals his identity according to the spiritual advancement of the devotee. But one who is not in the line of devotional service can hardly perceive him simply by calculations and philosophical speculations. Such a hard worker can present a jugglery of words before an audience, but can never know the Supreme Personality of Godhead in his personal feature. The Lord has clearly stated in the Bhagavad Gita that one can know him only by devotional service. No one can know the Lord by any puffed up material process of challenge, but the humble devotee can please the Lord by his earnest devotional activities. Thus the Lord reveals himself proportionately before the devotee. Lord Brahma, therefore, offers his respectful obeisances as a bona fide spiritual master and advises us to follow the process of Shravana and Kirtana. Simply by this process, or simply by hearing and chanting the glories of the activities of the Lord's incarnation, one can certainly see within himself the identity of the Lord. We have already discussed this subject in Volume 1 of Srimad Bhagavatam in connection with this verse, Tach Tradadana Munayo Jnana Vairagya Yuktaya Pashyantyatmani Chatmanam Bhaktya Shruta Grihitaya. The conclusion is that one cannot know the Supreme Personality of Godhead fully by any method, but he can be seen and felt partially by the devotional service process of hearing, chanting, and so forth. Gana Timidandasya Gananjana Shalakaya Chakshun Militam Yena Tasmai Sri Guruve Namaha Jai Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Sri Advaita Gadadha Sri Vasadi Gaur Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 A fundamental necessity in making progress in bhakti is to accept that knowledge of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, his name, form, quality, pastimes, so forth, cannot be understood or perceived by our, what we consider, normal senses. To accept this point requires genuine humility. We may consider that humility refers to a quality of speaking softly, lowering your head when you walk, perhaps offering pranams to everyone, folded hands. Those external gestures are certainly gentlemanly and ladylike, appropriate external characteristics, but the humility to accept that we are indeed born in the darkness of ignorance, Om Agyana Timirandasya, and in fact our eyes are forcibly shut. We choose to be an illusion. To accept that we do not have the required quality of sensory perception to grasp the Supreme Absolute Truth. That is real humility. This is why, at the end of Bhagavad Gita, Krishna gives his proposal. He requests, Sarva Dharmam Prachaja Mam Ekam Sharanam. Surrender your sense perception. Surrender your confidence in your sense perception and take my subjectivity, my sense perceptions, my opinions. So we discussed a few days ago how in Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says, that is my opinion. So yes, he's being subjective. You have an opinion, you have an opinion, Krishna has an opinion. But once you understand what is Krishna, then you can grasp that Krishna's opinion is the substance of reality. Just because Krishna is a person doesn't mean his opinion is deficient. By material calculation, we are accustomed to considering that any time a person makes an opinion, there's something lacking, there'll be some fault, there'll be some discrepancy. Who, after all, can have a perfect opinion? But Krishna challenges your material conceptions by stating, indeed, that is my opinion. In other words, Krishna is the supreme subjectivity, the supreme subjective person. His feelings, his personality, his emotions are what is. That is the reality. And as long as we try to feel and know and be emotional separate from Krishna, we are deep in the clutches of illusory energy. So bhakti yoga is all about how to be personal, how to be emotional, how your intelligence can function correctly. That means there must be the connection to the Supreme Personality of Godhead. We discussed a few days ago how Lord Brahma gave his testimony. He said, because of my connection to the Supreme Personality of Godhead, in fact, because my connection is full of fervor, enthusiasm, alacrity, life, because of that lively, earnest connection with the Supreme Personality of Godhead, therefore, my words that I speak, the knowledge I give, and my actions, what I do, is not they're not suspect. They are perfect because Brahma explains because of his connection to the Supreme Absolute Truth. He doesn't present himself as being for himself, of himself, by himself. He's talking to Narada Muni, and in this way, Brahma is perpetuating the parampara, the disciple succession. Narada Muni, as you recall, was wondering, I thought Brahma, my father, was all in all, but I see that he's meditating on someone beyond him. So that must mean that Brahma is not the cause of all causes. And indeed, Brahma is responding by explaining, I have a connection beyond me. And that connection to what's beyond me allows me to actually be correct in my words and in my deeds. So bhakti yoga is about accepting the limitations of our personality, emotions, thoughts, and feelings on their own. But when all those elements of our personal existence are connected to Krishna, then a whole unlimited world of perfect expression opens up. Think of the example of the unripe mango and the ripe mango. In the beginning stages, intermediate stages of bhakti, we are like the unripe mango that's gradually ripening. And as the mango gradually is ripening, its taste becomes very sweet and the juice increases. And then, when the mango is completely ripe, it is the king of fruits. The question is, will the unripe mango stay in the sun long enough to become ripe? That is the only question. If the unripe mango stays in the sun, it will become ripe. So therefore, looked at from one angle, the only difference between the ripe mango and the unripe mango is time, phases of development. So much of our devotional life is hearing about persistence, dedication, duty. As Srila Prabhupada writes here in the purport, one should not expect the Lord to be an order supplying agent who must be present before us as soon as we desire to see him. We must be ready to undergo the prescribed devotional duties following the path shown by the predecessors in the disciple succession from Brahma, Narada, and similar authorities. We've explained before how duty is very important in devotional service. It's not that duty is just something of the material world. And as you become more spiritual, you no longer have any concept of duty. The bedrock of bhakti is duty consciousness. By that duty consciousness, one's spiritual health gradually returns, and all the aspects of your individuality can make progress to functioning perfectly and purely in relation to Krishna. When Krishna asks us at the end of Bhagavad Gita to surrender to him, he's asking for practical humility. Admit that your senses are faulty and limited. Admit that you're in a trap, in that you're unable on your own to sort out yourself, to sort out your functioning in the universe. Admit that by following your own sensory and mental calculations, perceptions, you'll get nowhere. So this is what Krishna is asking for, that genuine humility that goes far beyond just speaking with a soft voice, which is nice, of course. Go goes far beyond walking softly. Goes far beyond mundane conceptions of meekness. The internal humility, which is the basis of all genuine external symptoms of humility, the internal humility is to understand that because of my material contamination, of my limited senses, I cannot understand Krishna. I cannot understand the Supreme Absolute Truth unaided by the Bhakti Yoga process. And the Bhakti Yoga process is all about purifying and transforming our senses so that indeed we can understand the transcendental existence of the personality of Godhead. Sometimes it is said, well, if here Brahma's explaining, we're glorifying the Supreme Absolute Truth, but he can hardly be fully known as he is. So someone could say, what's the use? You'll never know Krishna fully. So why don't you just give up? But why does it have to be the either or? Why not appreciate that because Krishna is unlimited, eternally our consciousness of Krishna will increase. Eternally, the love of Krishna will increase. So it's not a disadvantage that one can never fully know Krishna. We heard a few days ago how Krishna's baffled by his own pleasure potency. He knows his pleasure potency, and then his pleasure potency increases. And Krishna knows it again, and then the pleasure potency increases. We heard about how there's incremental increase eternally in Krishna's pleasure potency. And then the measuring of those incremental increases goes on eternally. So we are not afraid that you cannot understand Krishna fully. What Krishna is asking of us is to know him as much as we possibly can, according to our constitutional position as his parts and parcels. That's enough. When he asks you to surrender to him, he's saying, know me as much as I can be known. That is our responsibility. If you look at mental speculation, you find that often those addicted to mental gymnastics are hung up on what they consider to be two opposite poles. They say, all right, you God believers, this is what you're battling with. On the one hand, you want a God who has emotions, personality. You want a God who has individuality. Yet, there's others who want a God who is changeless, all-knowing, immeasurable. So how do these two things coincide? So mental speculator philosophies say that these two camps are always at war with each other. On the one side, make God a person with emotions, personal characteristics, personal activities. On the other side, God cannot be described. He is ineffable. He is like the clouds. Too subtle. Unchangeable. So the mental gymnastic persons conclude that because these two camps cannot come together, it shows you the futility of any intelligent person accepting that there is a Supreme Absolute Truth. Make up your mind, which camp do you want to be in? And then fight about it. Are you the type who says, God is emotional, he's a person, he has individuality? You'll fight with those who say, God is ineffable, God is is changeless. God is immeasurable. But Bhagavatam, of course, has nothing to do with these two opposite camps. Bhagavatam presents Krishna, who is a person, yet he's changeless, ineffable, immeasurable. This is what it means to be all attractive. Krishna is simultaneously personal and impersonal. But he himself says in Bhagavad Gita that his impersonal presence is subordinate to his personality. Just by logical common sense, you can get insight into that. It takes a person to be impersonal. Just like when you want to avoid someone, you give them the cold shoulder, you pretend the person doesn't exist even though they're in the same room. You can do that. You can be impersonal because you are a person. Your impersonal presence is subordinate to you, the person. Similarly, by your personal energies, you can arrange to have things done even though you're not apparently personally present. Whether it's organizing your home or organizing a business, the home, the business runs on your energy. So through logic, you can understand that it is highly plausible that the impersonal is subordinate to the personal. Of course, the real proof is not logic. The real proof is Shastra. Krishna explains himself, and that is a problem. Why should Krishna explain himself? He should just leave us alone to speculate. Leave us alone to become hung up between these two camps. Is God a person with qualities and emotions, or is God changeless, ineffable, immutable, so on and so forth? The mental speculator cannot conceive of both of these things simultaneously. That shows you the need for the bhakti process. You can't crack this nut, so to speak, on your own. So the atheists say, since there are these two camps of religionists always fighting with each other, why not just drop the whole thing? Then there'll be world peace. Why get hung up in all these battles about what is God? It's causing so much conflict, hatred. Just see the ridiculousness. You want God to be a person because you have personal needs. The other camp wants God to be immeasurable, ineffable, vague and formless. These things will never be resolved. So just let there be world peace by forgetting God. So then the speculators make a further point. Since there is this division between those who want God to be personal with qualities and those who say God is just amorphous, formless, vague, ineffable, the conclusion then obviously is there's a mystery. So accepting that there is a legitimate mystery that a human being should be concerned with. And of course, atheists don't think human beings should be concerned with such a mystery. They think you're wasting time, you're taking energy away from mundane politics and economics, you're taking time away from sorting out the human condition, and you're focused way off in the sky, you're dissipating all your skills, you're dissipating all your abilities, your possibilities for achievements. It all goes up in smoke as you stare at the mysterious unknown. All right, accepting that there is a mystery that you should be concerned with, and that's a big step forward for an atheistic mental speculator. Why should we be concerned with this mystery anyway? Even if you want to say that there is such a mystery, why be concerned with it? What is the practical effect of your being concerned with that mystery of the ultimate reality? What's the point? Why should you question? What is the point? Because how can a mystery give you practical instruction how to live down here on the ground. How can a mystery in the sky, whether it's personal, impersonal, whatever, life involves eating, sleeping, mating, defending. So many endeavors and achievements you're trying to do. Can the mystery give you concrete instructions about how to deal with that? No. Therefore, whether you accept that there's a mystery or not, the whole point's irrelevant. Brilliant, right? And you'll be better off by just jettisoning, throwing off the whole complexity. It's not necessary. And by getting caught up in this futile pursuit of the mystery, which has no practical relevance to your everyday life, you are siphoning off energies that could make this world a better place. So now you may say, well, if we don't accept that there is a supreme absolute truth, how can our life have any meaning? But the atheist asks you to consider. Just because you don't accept that there is a supreme cause of all causes, that doesn't mean you can't find meaning in your life. A mother finds meaning in the smile of her baby. The businessman finds meaning in expanding his financial empire. The scuba diver finds meaning in staring at coral reefs from under the water. Why do you laugh? This is meaning. Why do you laugh? A bedrock core principle of contemporary life is that everyone is entitled to their own meaning. Find your meaning however you like. So then the devotee will point out, all right, you're finding your so-called meaning this way or that way, but it's all temporary. It doesn't last. Well, the atheists have an argument for that. So what if it's temporary? Why does that rattle you? Why does that upset you? There are two things, as I see it, that you want to avoid. Number one is pain. Number two is boredom. If you are eternal, isn't that boring? You just go on and on and on and on. Wouldn't it be better that there's an end? Then they give the proof that human beings are afraid of boredom, and even when they posit that there's eternal life, they can't come up with any solution to boredom. And what's the proof? The average churchgoer, temple-goer, mosque-goer, synagogue-goer spends an hour or two a week glorifying the supreme mystery and then clears out, leaves the place. They can't handle more than an hour or two of glorifying God. They just do it out of obligation. They say they like to do it, but after 1 hour service, 2 hour service, that's it. So, if they can't handle an hour or two worship ceremony every Saturday or Sunday, whatever their religion says, how are they going to handle eternally glorifying God? Ha ha. You devotees know, when you're chanting japa, what are you thinking? When's it going to end, right? 10 rounds. I've got to squeeze out another 6, otherwise everyone says I'm in Maya. And then you're going to tell everyone that perfection is glorifying Krishna eternally? How do you know you're not going to be bored? If there is a spiritual world, you could be completely bored just glorifying Krishna. The proof is you can't glorify Krishna for a couple of hours now. If I just drop the whole thing, find meaning your own way. Of course, the response is given in the purport that just because our material senses cannot properly fathom and relish the name, form, quality, pastimes of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, nevertheless, when our senses are purified, the whole situation changes. Rupa Goswami explains in Nectar of Instruction, Sat Krishna Nama Charitari, Sitopi Vidya, Bitopatasya Rasanasya Narojika. The holy name of Krishna is like sugar candy, but because our tongue is contaminated, that sugar candy may even seem to taste bitter, and therefore we struggle when we chant. But Rupa Goswami assures you, if you carefully chant the holy name of Krishna every day, the disease that's afflicting your tongue will be destroyed at the root. So in that way, we can see there is hope for our senses when they are purified. So this is the basis of the bhakti program, purifying the senses. For us, boredom is not an issue. Any devotee who absorbs himself, herself, in the bhakti process, in the association of devotees, if you're actively striving to engage your senses in Krishna's service, you'll never know what is boredom. One of my godbrothers, Vajranarayan Prabhu, was telling me how his father was an educated man, kind of professor or something, psychologist. So, after getting over his initial disturbance because his son became a devotee, after 20, 25, 30 years of his son's doing devotional service, his father said to him, so you've been doing this now for 30 years. Don't you ever get bored? So his son explained to him, Dad, in my 30 years of practicing bhakti, I've experienced the full range of emotions, from intense ecstasy to intense anger and everything in between. But I have to honestly tell you, I've never been bored. We can see that in our humble attempts to serve Krishna Association of Devotees. Sometimes there's frustrations with ourselves. I can't serve Krishna properly. Frustrations with other devotees. They're not serving Krishna properly. There's anger. I'm being minimized. I'm not being respected. If they only knew and listened to me, things would be much better. There's sadness when you see devotees drop their devotional practices and you see Maya swallow them up. There's greed, the beginnings of spiritual greed, which is a very precious state, lolium. The beginnings can be seen in this. Can't get enough devotional service, can't get enough kirtan. So, there's also lust. Narottam Das Thakur says, Kama Krishna Karmarpane. Lust is perfectly used in Krishna's service by wanting indeed to engage everything in Krishna's service, wanting everything for Krishna's pleasure. So, there's the full range of emotional expression in bhakti. And as the unripe mango ripens, the sweetness, the juice becomes better and better. But boredom? Now that I think of it, talking to devotees in just this temple community over the decades, I've heard devotees say that, one devotee was telling me yesterday, I can't handle the intensity of living in the ashram. I can't handle the intensity of being a staff member. Something's always happening. I can't handle it. But I've never heard anyone say, I'm bored. Never heard that one. Quite a few times. Especially when ladies reach the age of 27, 28, 29. And I've noticed men, especially when they get into their early 30s, you know, maybe the ashram life is not for me. I need to have my own stability, my own peace. But I never heard that I'm bored. So that shows you something. Indeed, Bhagavatam explains that the super soul in the heart of a sincere devotee makes all devotional activities ever fresh. Therefore, you can externally be doing the same thing, the same so-called rituals, but internally, every day is different. This is the glory of bhakti. Sometimes our memory fails us and we forget the sameness and boredom of material life and material affairs, material relationships. We forget that. That quality of stagnancy. Same old, same old. Dealing with someone's physiology and psychology day after day on the material platform. Very stale. No one likes stale bread, but that is the quality of the material experience that the illusory energy presents to you. But you don't see it until it's too late, until you stick your foot in. From afar, the material energy looks like it has possibilities for us. It can look kind of exciting, alluring. Even fulfilling. Of course, you tell yourself, it won't be completely fulfilling. I know. I know the philosophy. But there'll be something. And that something, that's good enough for me. This is the materialist mantra. They want you to buy in to this. It's good enough. It's not perfect. It's not the best. But it's good enough for you. It's something to do. Something to get your senses into. You can make a mark on the world. You can make an imprint. You can make your own meaning. Even though it's temporary, so what? It's something. And even if you had eternity, what would you do with it? You'd be bored. Because to the mind of a materialist, how could you just go on chanting Hare Krishna eternally? What is this Kirtaniya Sadahari? Always chant Hare Krishna. They can't conceive. And this is the difficulty you may have with your family and former friends. They wonder, what are you doing? How can you just chant Hare Krishna and be happy? It's the same thing. And then, back to the point we were making. Okay, you are embracing the mystery. But what can that mystery tell you about your practical daily life? How can the mystery tell you how to live, how to have a family? How can a mystery tell you what to do with your money? Of course, Bhagavatam tells us, dharmam tisaksha bhagavat pranitam. The path of dharma, how to properly live, comes directly from the Supreme Personality of Godhead. We are not dogmatically pushing some kind of religious belief. We are offering the practical program for purifying the mind and senses, so that indeed you can perceive the Supreme Personality of Godhead as much as he can be perceived. Of course, in the topmost portion of the spiritual world, in Goloka Vrindavan, no one knows Krishna's God, and Krishna doesn't want them to know he's God because it spoils the fun. The residents of Vrindavan are at the pinnacle of Vedic knowledge. They are playing with the goal of the Vedas. They are romancing with the goal of the Vedas. They are feeding the goal of the Vedas. So at the pinnacle of spiritual perfection, it's not so much knowing Krishna as God, it is all about loving Krishna purely. And the purity of that love is such that Krishna can choose to come under its control. In Chaitanya Charitamrita, Krishnadas Kaviraj Goswami points out that the most inconceivable thing about the Supreme Absolute Truth is that the infinite Supreme Absolute Truth can agree to come under the control, to become subordinate to the infinitesimal part and parcel devotee. At the core of everyone's heart, they want satisfying love. The importance of the bhakti knowledge is that it leads to that perfectly satisfying love. Therefore, understanding Krishna as much as he can be known is of the utmost importance. The more we know about Krishna, the more we're attracted. And who are you to say that the Supreme Absolute Truth cannot give directives about how human beings can live, should live? We see in Krishna's Dwarka Leela, for the benefit of the human beings, he's demonstrating perfect household life. How to keep the Supreme Absolute Truth in the center of all your family affairs. So not only is he giving instruction how to do that, he's demonstrating while being the supreme enjoyer at the same time. Therefore, when Krishna rises in Dwarka and does his morning rituals, he shows you. In the morning, you should meditate on the Supreme Absolute Truth. So he does that. He meditates on himself. He's true to his nature. So not only does the Supreme Personality of Godhead give instruction, but he also gives demonstration. And the most vivid demonstration is when he decides to become his own devotee, to show us how to be devotees, while simultaneously tasting the most confidential flavors of love of Krishna. Krishna himself wants to taste the confidential flavors of love of Krishna. And while he is tasting that as Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, he's teaching you how to be a devotee. So this is the height of the Supreme Absolute Truth being an interventionist. According to mundane speculation, human beings have this desire that God should intervene. But their extent of understanding God as an interventionist is like God reaching into human affairs and causing an earthquake, killing human beings. Or God reaches into human affairs and distributes wealth and prosperity to everyone. The mundane mind cannot conceive of the Supreme Personality of Godhead intervening by personally demonstrating how to live perfectly as a devotee, how to live perfectly in family life, how to live perfectly as a renunciate. So Srimad Bhagavatam goes far beyond mundane calculation. It's a very threatening book to someone who is attached to their sense perception as all in all. Bhagavatam is giving the knowledge of the Supreme Absolute Truth and is giving the process by which you can perceive the supreme absolute truth. And it's telling me all the benefits. And you can't help but be attracted because you are eternally Krishna's partner, Carson. Therefore, the emphasis on Shravana, hearing, and Kirtan, glorifying. It's natural for us. And by engaging in those fundamental bhakti processes, gradually the senses become purified and Krishna becomes known as much as he can be known to a tiny part and parcel. But that's our responsibility, is to know Krishna as much as he can be known so that we can engage in perfect loving affairs with Krishna. So the bhakti knowledge is very active and transformative. And it's 100% in relation to our deepest core desires, which are to engage in perfect relationships. Lord Brahma, by his instruction to Narada Muni in this chapter, is clearing the way for knowledge of Krishna's times. He's saying, let us offer our respectful obeisances unto that Supreme Personality of Godhead, whose incarnations and activities are chanted by us for glorification, although he can hardly be fully known as he is. Just because he cannot be fully known, that doesn't mean we're not going to offer our obeisances. Can't help but be attracted because you are eternally Krishna's partner, Carson. Therefore, the emphasis on Shravana, hearing, and Kirtan, glorifying. It's natural for us. And by engaging in those fundamental bhakti processes, gradually the senses become purified and Krishna becomes known as much as he can be known to a tiny part and parcel. That's our responsibility, is to know Krishna as much as he can be known so that we can engage in perfect loving affairs with Krishna. So the bhakti knowledge is very active and transformative. And it's 100% in relation to our deepest core desires, which are to engage in perfect relationships. Lord Brahma, by his instruction to Narada Muni in this chapter, is clearing the way for knowledge of Krishna's pastimes. He's saying, let us offer our respectful obeisances unto that Supreme Personality of Godhead, whose incarnations and activities are chanted by us for glorification, although he can hardly be fully known as he is. Just because he cannot be fully known, that doesn't mean we're not going to offer our obeisances. All right, stop here. Any questions? Our brains are structured by time and space. Even mundane philosophers like Kant, they accept that. Inherently, the very thought mechanism is conditioned, in other words. It operates within time and space. So therefore, when the acharyas give us explanations about Krishna, they know, of course, that Krishna is beyond time and space. Yet, at the same time, our thinking process is inherently a time and space phenomenon. phenomena. So, although it seems like a sequence is being presented, step one, Krishna knows himself. Step two, Krishna expands. Step three, Krishna has to know himself again. This is a time-bound understanding. But what can you do? Your thought processes in conditioned life are inherently bound up with time. But that doesn't mean Krishna's bound up with time. Krishna lives in the eternal present. In the spiritual world, there's no past or future as we know it. There seems to be past and future as like props on the stage just to enhance Krishna's pastimes. The sun rises, the sun sets, but there's no effect of time passing. By the sun's rising and setting in Goloka Vrindavan, it's just instigating various leelas, that's all. It's not causing the corroding effect of time. There's no step one, step two, step three. That's a material sequence dependent on time and space. So just to give you a glimpse, such a sequence is presented. Just to give you a glimpse of how inconceivable Krishna is. He's so inconceivable that his potencies expand and his knowledge expands to keep up with his potencies. And of course, to understand the greatest issue, what is Krishna's greatest issue that he has to understand? How is it that my dearest devotee loves me? What is it that my dearest devotee tastes in me? What's the position like that my dearest devotee occupies? What are the qualities in me that are being tasted? That's Krishna's greatest issue. Therefore, he becomes a devotee. He becomes as Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. So we have our issues we're trying to understand about the Supreme Absolute Truth. Krishna also has his issues. But he perfectly resolves his issues as Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. The two become one. Radha and Krishna become one. Now, as Chaitanya Charitamrita points out, what are you going to do? Calculate. Okay, when Krishna desired to... if a Radha Krishna become one, or Krishna becomes Radha and Krishna, when... as Prabhupada explains, this is all just the talk of a conditioned perception. It's not exactly like that. Past, present, and future. First Krishna was like this. He was Radha and Krishna. And then some time passed and he thought, no, I don't want to be... I want to understand Radha Krishna as a devotee. But because our minds are immersed and indeed structured by time, things are presented in that way. But simultaneously, you're always warned. Krishna is beyond the influence of time. His pastimes are beyond time. So we have to look at the whole picture. Okay. Anything else? Yes.
Maharaj, today is a very auspicious day. Appearance of Gopal Bhatt Goswami. You want to tell us something? Gopal Bhatt Goswami.
Anandam Bhuri Bhajanayaka Nipuno. As a member of the six Goswamis of Vrindavan, Gopabhatta Goswami is always working to expand the limits of the ocean of transcendental bliss. The material ocean of happiness is stagnant, but the spiritual ocean of transcendental bliss, by its very essence, is always increasing. So the six Goswamis of Vrindavan, including Gopabhatta Goswami, they are doing that service by their hearing and chanting about Krishna. They are assisting Krishna in expanding the limits of that Ananda Kund.
express Maharaj.
Yes? First, there is duty consciousness. Your duty as a green mango is to stay in the sun. Just like our Minister of Health, Holiness Prahlad Anamaraj, will tell you. If you don't get any sunlight, and you don't take vitamin D supplements, you're going to have some problems. Even if you don't like the sunlight, you have to do something if you want sufficient vitamin D. Mm-hmm. So it's your duty to your body to make sure you get enough sunlight, even if you're from Siberia. Otherwise, you have to make some kind of adjustment. Better to get natural sunlight, but for some reason you can't do that, then you have to take supplements which are not as efficient as getting sunlight. If you have more brown in your skin, you actually need more sunlight. So you do it out of duty. You take care of your health out of duty. Similarly, in terms of your spiritual life, the green mango stays in the sun out of duty, whether you feel like it or not. That stage is necessary. I once asked a mother who had a little child, I said, "Do you like being a mother?" And she looked at me and said, "I don't have a choice." It's a done deal. So similarly, it's not a bad thing that we don't have a choice once we've signed up. We accept the medical treatment. Power of vrata, vow. I made these vows, I'll keep them. I'll stay in the sun. Now, that doesn't mean everything is hopeless just because you're an unripe mango. Who knows how to make green mango chutney? Right? Very tasty, very healthy. So even green mangoes, you know, they are attractive. But of course, there's nothing like a perfectly ripe mango. That is what we aspire for. It's worth the wait. It's worth the effort. It's worth the ups and downs and the roller coaster rides.